From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The L.A. County Board of Supervisors canceled a $1.7 billion contract to replace the Men's Central Jail in downtown Los Angeles. Supervisors said they want to look instead at a rehabilitative and mental health model in lieu of incarceration. The question is, what comes next for the inmates who are held at the Central Jail? Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Hope you're having a good day. Coming up later this hour, we're going to take a look at emotional relationships online, how they affect real-world relationships. Not talking not necessarily online sexual relationships, but emotional relationships with someone other than a spouse or romantic partner and how that affects those relationships. But first, we begin by what the future holds for those that are housed at the L.A. Men's Central Jail. The L.A. County Board of Supervisors earlier this week voted 4-1 to back away from a contract that would create a new jail mental health facility. The idea would be that the significant numbers of individuals who have serious mental health problems who are housed at the Central Jail would get more extensive mental health services. But there were concerns that the emphasis would be on incarceration as opposed to providing those services. Now the question is, what comes next for those who are at the Central Jail, which everyone agrees is dilapidated and not up to handling the needs of those who are housed there? With us, Los Angeles Times reporter Matt Stiles, who's covering the issue. Matt, thank you for being with us.
Hi, good to be with you.
So what is proposed as the replacement for the Central Jail in lieu of the project that's been canceled?
Well, nothing right now. I think what the supervisors have said they would like to do is for the chief executive officer of the county to cobble together studies and a pending study and report that's coming out to try to build a strategy going forward for what types of facility or facilities they might build, where and when, and you know who to contract with. So it's really up in the air at this point. What's next?
So does this further delay then for those that are housed at Men's Central Jail better conditions for them? Is this going to take longer for them to get some relief?
In theory, yes. So the way the original plan, you know, this has been an evolution over the last several years with different plans. But the most recent plan that had just been scrapped by the supervisors this week had called for replacing the Men's Central Jail with a new mental health treatment facility. And the plan was to move inmates from the Men's Central Jail to another jail and move mental health inmates into this new facility. And so that would have given over the next few years relief to the folks inside the Men's Central Jail. But now that timeline gets pushed back, you know, years potentially, given the amount of time it takes to secure a new contract, to design a facility, to get all the input from the community before you ever break ground.
And do we know the numbers of what we're talking about, the number of people who could safely go into mental health services but wouldn't need to be in a jail facility for security or safety issues versus those who need to be jailed because of the safety issues involved? Do we know the numbers we're talking about?
We know that there are 17,000 people at any given day in the network of jails in LA County, and a good number of them, depending on what metric you use, anywhere from a third to half or even over half, suffer from medical or mental health issues that require them to have extra care. And there is an Office of Diversion Policy at the county that for the last couple of years has been studying and seeking ways to divert less violent offenders or, you know, accused people to community programs, to other types of facilities to get them out of decentralized jails. And there had been a goal an ambitious goal of around 50% of the population being diverted in some way to either a program or another facility. And this new construction was intended to kind of help with that. And it's just unclear whether that goal is realistic. There's some debate at the Sheriff's Department and among the supervisors about whether that goal is even realistic. You know, there are just thousands of violent people accused of violent crimes, or people who've been convicted of violent crimes or awaiting trial for violent crimes. There's 1,000 people in the jails alone on a homicide charge. It's really hard to imagine a system where you don't have a new facility where people can be housed in a secure environment.
Well, and we're also in this era where people, constantly in response to violent incidents are talking about, why weren't people paying attention to red flags, people with serious mental health issues or, aggressiveness against others? Why do you have to wait until something violent happened to deal with that? And, one of the questions here is, how do you identify someone who is, potential violent risk as opposed to someone who's got a serious mental health problem that needs to be treated but isn't a threat to the community?
And that's part of the challenge. I mean, some of it in determining who needs to be housed in a secure facility and who doesn't really goes by the nature of the charges. But even folks who are in the jails on serious charges, almost everyone agrees, that's making policy for the county. They need to be in a facility that's built for a modern inmate, that has communal areas, has natural light, where there aren't sort of dungeon-like, cavernous halls or corridors where inmates can get lost or forgotten and they're not getting the care that they need. And so the goal is, even if you do have large numbers of people housed in these facilities, that they're built to a standard that gives them a little bit more of a therapeutic environment.
We're talking with Matt Stiles, LA Times reporter, who's been closely following the future of the county jail, Men's Central Jail, which everyone agrees isn't a fit place for people to be held. The question is, what will succeed it now that supervisors have canceled a $1.7 billion project to build a downtown mental health treatment center to replace the Central Jail? Critics have said it really isn't a mental health treatment center, is just a new jail. With us, the director of campaigns and policy at Dignity and Power Now, who's been working on the campaign to stop the new jail's construction in LA County, Lex Stepling. Mr. Stepling, thank you for being with us. What do you think should replace the Men's Central Jail?
Thank you for having me. I think that sometimes we talk about violence the wrong way, because there's this presumption that jailing is somehow a remedy to violence. And the reality is and has been and continues to show itself to be that jails are perpetuations of violence. And that if somebody has mental health issues or behavioral health issues or other forms of instability, their conditions deteriorate when in contact with the jail system, the court system, and the sheriff's department. And so it's been a failure all around, wholesale. And over and over and over again, we see that when jail numbers rapidly drop, public safety actually benefits. And so one of the answers is actually not to replace a bad jail with a new jail. It's to get rid of jailing altogether and invest in community-based systems of care. So the reporter from the Times mentioned earlier that Los Angeles County has an Office of Diversion and Reentry. And one can take a very quick look at their numbers. And let's be clear that they have diverted people out of the jail system facing all kinds of charges, not just ones that we might think of as kind of easier or low level. They've diverted people out of the system who are facing serious charges. And their rate of success with regards to people not reoffending has been 80%, which would put the numbers that the jailing system would produce to shame, as they have a recidivism rate of upwards of 90%. So what we see over and over again, what we see in jurisdictions around the country, is that when diversion is scaled up, when people are taken out of a jail-based conditions and placed into community-based systems of care, violence goes down. So when we say something like reducing our jail population in LA County by 50% is ambitious, it's actually just a pretty reasonable starting point when you consider how far ahead we are with relationship to the rest of the country, numbers-wise.
How many beds do you think would be ideal for there to be for those who are held now at Men's Central Jail? Do you think would be a danger to have released and need to be separated from the rest of the population? What would be a reasonable number of beds to you?
Well, when we talk about beds, what are we talking about? Are we talking about jail-like conditions? Because that doesn't do anything to remedy violence. Beds is a kind of a metric or a unit of measurement with regards to how we direct resources into preventative steps, into addressing violence. That's the conversation I think we want to have as a county. That's part of what was very good about the vote on Tuesday to cancel that contract, because that contract was based on a jail footprint. And we know that jails reproduce the problem. So, again, for example,
there's something I'm missing here. So if you take individuals, let's use your 80-20 recidivism rate. You're talking about only a 20% recidivism rate for someone who's in a diversion program. But if you have someone who's incarcerated for, let's say, several year period of time because that individual's threatened to kill someone, and you're buying 10 years or however many years that person's separated from society, yes, they may reoffend once they're ultimately released and perhaps at a higher rate of diversion. But isn't someone who's put into diversion a 20% reoffending rate? Isn't that apt to happen at a much sooner period because there's access that individual to get to society to commit a crime?
Well, you're speaking in abstractions, and that's not...
No. I'm talking in real terms of years. I'm talking about the length of time someone's separated out in a prison versus the time someone can access another individual to do harm while in diversion.
Okay, so let's do the inverse of this rhetorical setup that you're saying. Jailing, as you claim, jailing has a 90% recidivism rate, which means that when people go through the jail system, the likelihood of repeat violence is far higher than diversion, far, far higher.
But aren't the people less likely to reoffend the ones who are getting diversion? Isn't that part of its better success rate?
No, it's not. I said that earlier, that people facing all different kinds of charges have shown success rates through the Office of Diversion and Reentry. The data is hard and it's transparent and it's clear.
So that's not data across the board. That's data for the most serious offenders. Because I'm saying we're talking about two different populations, because the people that go into diversion are not the same threat level as the people who are in the jail. Right, on average?
Larry, for the third time, people facing serious charges have also shown the same success rate through the Office of Diversion and Reentry, which is one pilot program. If you look at other jurisdictions, the numbers are the same. So look at a jurisdiction like New York, where they once had an average daily population of 25,000. Our current average daily population in L.A., as it was stated, is 17,000. So it's not ambitious to want to cut that in half and get us to around 8,000. When you look at New York, which is now down to 7,000, and their violent crime statistics have gone way, way, way down since the days of 25,000. So again, there's a continuum of evidence that states that diversion as one solution works far better than the creation of more jails.
Okay, and let me just clarify. You're saying the rate of recidivism for those in diversion is the same across the board for someone who's there on, let's say, a drug trafficking offense as someone who's there for a violent crime. It's across the board the same recidivism rate in diversion.
The rigor that goes into assessment for diversion is done through the lens of practitioners who tend to be far more interested in positive outcomes than the Sheriff's Department. The Sheriff's Department, Alec Villanueva claimed during his campaign that the data he had was bad, that Sheriff McDonald kept bad data. So the data that now they're producing, trying to claim that this progress away from jailing is harmful is the same data that they claimed was bad. So there's that needs to be noted as well. But if there are 1,000 people in L.A. County jails, which that's the first I've heard of that data, if there are 1,000 people in the L.A. County jail system who are facing homicide charges, then there needs to be very rigorous, accurate assessment on how we deal with violence, how we deal with harm, how we invest in services for families who've gone through the trauma of violent crime, rather than using that as an excuse to keep perpetuating a system that has failed to do anything about violence. You mentioned we're in a time where people are saying, well, why wasn't anything done? The reason things weren't done is because the investment is in punishment. The investment is in post-haste responses rather than in prevention, rather than an accurate mental health assessment, and rather than community-based systems of care. So now Los Angeles is finally taking a step forward to invest in community-based systems of care, which actually answers many of those concerns on the front end.
And of course, the other issue is getting enough mental health practitioners who are willing to work with this population and being able to deal with the numbers we're talking about here as well. Lex Stepling with us, Dignity and Power Now, part of Justice LA, a campaign that attempted to stop the replacement of LA Men's Central Jail with a $1.7 billion project that the LA County Board of Supervisors turned aside earlier this week. Coming up, we'll talk with Joseph Charney, who worked for former Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky as Justice Deputy for the former supervisor. He's involved with the process of coming up with a replacement for Men's Central Jail. We'll get his thoughts about this. Back with more in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're talking about what the future holds in a replacement for the L.A. County Men's Central Jail. Joseph Charney with us, who was Justice Deputy for former L.A. County Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky, worked on the jail replacement issue for a number of years. Mr. Charney, good to have you with us. Your thoughts about the supervisor's vote?
Well, it's very disappointing. I mean, tens of millions of dollars of planning and consulting costs have been given, thousands and thousands of hours. And when I was at the meeting, there is no information whatsoever that has come in to indicate that we should divert from our notion of replacing this dungeon-like jail, this Men's Central Jail that's been around for 60 years. It's absolutely incapable of really housing people humanely. And we have to put those people in the Twin Towers location, and we have to put the people who are now securing mental health treatment in Twin Towers, we have to put them in a new mental health facility. You know, I listened to the gentleman who spoke before. We have to deal with violence. You know, the fact is that young people get abused at home, and then they're victims. But when they go out and they rape and rob and murder, they victimize. And the criminal justice system has a duty to protect the community. It has a duty to treat people when they're in jail humanely. In fact, we have a constitutional duty to treat them appropriately when they're in our facilities. The irony is we don't have a constitutional duty to treat the mentally ill, the homeless, out on the streets. That's another issue. It is a continuum from the streets to the jails. But, you know, the fact is it can be, people are talking about it being inmate-centered. It has to be also victim-centered. The community has to be protected. You have to have a balance in the criminal justice system. You have to properly resource defense counsel so they can represent people accused of crime, and you have to properly resource the facilities that house dangerous criminals. And let me tell you, at the jail, in the jail, 17,000, three-quarters have committed serious and violent felonies. There are no more misdemeanors. It's hardly in the jail. 47 has the limit. We turned felonies into misdemeanors, and the misdemeanors stay in jail for 14 days.
So what about Lex Stepling's argument that when you put those violent offenders into programs to rehabilitate them, that their recidivism rate is as low as people who go in for minor offenses, that this is an 80% solution to the problem. They don't reoffend.
Well, first of all, I want to say that the notion that diversion is going to solve this problem, I call it the diversion delusion. I mean, when you have so many people who are in jail for very serious crimes, no one's going to deny that in general, it's probably more helpful to treat people out of jail than in jail. But that's not the only consideration. I mean, you just have to listen to the news and see people's behavior out there. We can't predict violent behavior. When people commit crimes that are violent, they should be treated where it is safe to treat them. And as far as, you know, I didn't even hear the word victim from the gentleman before. I didn't hear the word community safety from him. This is an ideological approach to the criminal justice system. And the Board of Supervisors are derelict in duty by just following that approach. They should really consider the facts, the evidence. You know, we went through 8 years, 7 years. We had consultants coming in. The health departments have basically told the Board of Supervisors what's needed. The sheriff has told. Probation department is told. The DA has said diversion is not an answer to jail reduction. Yet they ignore it all, you know, and they sing Imagine There's No Prisons. Well, that's a good song. And maybe the gentleman before me can say it, but not the Board of Supervisors. They have a responsibility to 10 million people in this county.
All right. On the issue of mental health services, given the vast numbers of people we're talking about and what's said to be the largest mental health facility in the country, and that is L.A. County's custodial jails, are there enough mental health clinicians? Could enough people, even if you had the money, are there enough people to provide the services to meet the needs of the population we're talking about? Or is this more theoretical than practical?
Well, I don't know if we have all that we need, but I think that there could be more effective treatment of people who will probably resist treatment when they get out and have committed very serious crimes in the context of a jail facility. Now, let's understand something. One of our consultants indicated that by 2025, we're going to need about 6,500 new beds for people because of this mental illness increase, which increases every year. We're going to need far more resources. We need resources to help the people in the street. There's no question about it. But I think we have to focus on the fact that we had conceived of an institution that was humane. How did the Board of Supervisors allow the Men's Central Jail to continue to exist? You know, if you go down there, and I've been there, it is horrific. It is horrific. And we have to get rid of it. And we can build a better facility. And then we have to deal with crime and mental illness and development. These are other issues. And of course, they're important issues. We have to deal with child abuse. We have to deal with violence in the streets. We have to have better education, et cetera, et cetera. But also, we have to be balanced here.
Well, I'd like to hear from listeners. What do you think of the idea of the overwhelming majority of offenders, the majority are violent offenses who are currently in L.A. County custody, putting those individuals into diversion programs instead of incarcerating them? Do you think that that is a feasible way of dealing with it, or would that cause concerns for you for public safety? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. The figure that was cited by our guest Lex Stepling is that only 20% of the violent offenders who go through the program instead of go into jail end up reoffending again. Are you comfortable with that? 866-893-KPCC says the figures are far worse for recidivism for those that are in the jail system. Do you think that that is a better alternative to jail, and that it would be best to have few or no jail cells in L.A. County? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. JP writes, is it punishment or is it just keeping them from the people they could hurt? I don't like the idea of murder murderers walking the streets after X number of years behind bars, I'd rather keep them in for life until we have a good reason to believe they won't hurt anyone. Well, there's, you know, sentences that you have to adhere to as to when someone's going to be released from custody. But this is really the issue about whether a diversion program can keep the public as safe or safer than having someone who is separated out from the population while in jail or prison. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lex Stepling of Dignity and Power Now, Joseph Charney making the point that this was all studied, experts gave their input on it. This was a years-long process where this was determined to be the best alternative. Your response?
There's a lot to respond to. There's a lot of presumption in Charney's points, and so I need to start by addressing a couple of them. You know, I was a childhood victim of a violent crime in 1987, and that person went on to be sentenced to consecutive life sentences, serving much of their time in Pelican Bay, Corcoran, and Corcoran State Prison, as well as Tehachapi. What I learned from that experience was that the system that Charney's advocating for does not serve victims, does not bring resources into our communities, does not bring resources into our families. Rather, it takes resources from us and puts them into this expansive, bloated, inefficient, and harmful system of mass incarceration. And it gets proven over and over and over again that it does not equate to positive impacts. When we talk about the numbers, the success rate of one particular diversion program, that's a pretty strong set of numbers. And you're skewing it around violent, so-called violent offenders. This is across the board that number is highly successful. The other piece being that we do need to invest in systems where we can talk about what does removal without harm look like? What does it look like to remove a person from the community who poses an acute threat or acute danger? The reality is that when Charney mentions so-called convicted violent offenders in LA County Jail, he's wrong. We're talking about people facing charges. People have been accused. So the numbers are inaccurate. The framing is inaccurate. And frankly, he's being very selective about his points, because if we do want to pour through the numbers, if we want to do that work, the numbers over and over and over again state that things like diversion and alternatives to incarceration produce vastly higher public safety impacts in every city and every jurisdiction across the country. I think that an investment in things like prevention to violence, because we're right, we can't predict it, and predictive policing, for example, has been proven not to work. What we can do is invest in accurately providing care to our communities and taking resources away from jailing, away from reactive-based punitive measures, and into prevention and into services and into addressing the trauma that we face in communities like Los Angeles. And it's ironic, given that he works for a board that when they were in office, that failed to address these problems, which is why we had such high spikes in violence during that era. Again, when we invest in prevention, when we invest in community-based systems of care, public safety impacts go up. So it's actually okay. Not at all an ideological conversation, but a practical one.
All right. We're talking with Lex Stepling, Dignity and Power Now, Joseph Charney, who was Justice Deputy for former L.A. County Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky. Let me bring up some listener points here. Yvette in South Los Angeles says nearly half the people in jail are there pre-trial, and being able to divert those individuals would significantly reduce the jail population by 7,000 people. Joseph Charney, you want to respond to Yvette's point?
Well, they're talking about, you know, changing the bail system, and it's possible that some of those individuals will be placed on bail. But make no mistake, when you have 75% of the people who have been accused of serious or violent felonies, the idea that they can be placed safely, diverted, and going to come back when they're supposed to come back, or actually they're serving time, I think is absolutely a dream. Look, the gentleman before me is right. We need services out in the community, but he has to recognize also, and I'm sure he does, that the inner city communities are the ones that are hit the hardest by this crime. The most violence is going on there. The most, you know, destructive behavior. There are many people in this county who do not suffer that kind of are not victimized that way. And I think it's irresponsible not to accept the fact that there are certain individuals who really have to be incarcerated. Not everybody can be cured with mental health treatment. that truly is a delusion, and it's a very destructive one.
All right, we need to break. I want to thank you both very much. Joseph Charney, Justice Deputy for former Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky, back when Zev was an L.A. County Supervisor. Lex Stepling of Dignity and Power Now. He'd been working with Justice L.A., the group wanting the Board of Supervisors to reverse course on the new mental health facility to replace L.A. Men's Central Jail. The board voted to do just that 4-1 earlier this week. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll turn our attention to relationships online, not just sexual relationships or sexting, but emotionally supportive relationships online. Can they do damage to, in the real physical world, relationships? We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Tomorrow on Film Week at 11, our critics tell us what they think of Where'd You Go, Bernadette? New film from director, writer Richard Linklater. Cate Blanchett stars. We'll also hear about the Angry Birds movie 2 and Good Boys, which quizzically is an R-rated comedy featuring 3 sixth grade boys. That's an interesting juxtaposition. Good Boys. We'll hear about that coming up tomorrow on Film Week here on 89.3 KPECC. But we turn our attention to a recent survey, iFidelity, the State of Our Unions 2019, which looks at attitudes of cohabiting Gen Xers, millennials, and other groups like baby boomers to see what they think about online emotional relationships. And interestingly, shows that younger Americans are more tolerant of online emotional relationships. This might be following an ex-girlfriend or boyfriend online, not sharing that with the person with whom you're in a relationship. It could be striking up an online relationship, not necessarily sexual, but one in which there's personal disclosures about the real-world relationship the person's in, sharing about intimate emotional things, and getting emotional support from someone else online. Joining us to talk about the survey is University of Virginia Professor of Sociology and Senior Fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, Brad Wilcox. Good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
It's good to be here today as well.
I appreciate it. So let's talk about the iFidelity survey, the National Marriage Project, which you direct, was involved with conducting this. What do you think's at play with the generational differences in perception here?
Well, I think that younger adults are more likely to have extensive experience interacting with others, obviously online, in a variety of contexts, from Snapchat to Instagram. And it seems like they've just become a little more comfortable online, but that also translates into a greater willingness to sort of push boundaries. So if they're married or cohabiting, they're more likely than older Americans to think it's okay, for instance, to have a secret online emotional relationship, or to follow an old girlfriend or boyfriend online.
And do we have any sense how extensive these, how many people find themselves in these kinds of online emotional relationships? Again, all the attention goes to sexting and people engaging in online, sexual activity. But it goes far beyond that, as this survey indicates.
Right. So almost 20% of younger adults today, those who are under 35, report that they've had a secret online emotional relationship, either married or cohabiting. And that's much higher than those, say, who are boomers. It's about 7% for baby boomers. And when it comes to kind of what seems like a more innocuous behavior, following an old girlfriend or an old boyfriend, More than 35% of younger adults report doing that while married or cohabiting. And again, that's much higher than their older peers, be they Gen Xers, boomers, or members of the Great Generation.
So I'd love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener, how you've dealt with this in your relationship. You have a partner or spouse who you discovered was engaged in an emotional relationship online, either with an ex or with someone they met online or, you know, met through social media. How did you deal with that within the context of your relationship? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Was this something that you talked about early on in your relationship with your significant other? Did you raise the issue of, you know, whether you feel this is being unfaithful to have an emotional relationship with someone online? You know, for some people, as we see from this survey, they don't see that as being unfaithful emotionally or in any other way. For some individuals, they see this as a betrayal of the relationship, that for them, the assumption is that the emotional reliance of sharing intimate details of, you know, talking about the primary relationship, that doing that outside of the relationship is a violation, is a lack of fidelity. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, professor and as well as therapist, Catherine Hertline. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Is this something you recommend that couples talk about, you know, very early on, in case they have differing perceptions of this kind of activity?
They have to talk about it, and often they do. One of the things that actually surprises me as a therapist, working with couples in the generation that that Brad was discussing, is that they don't have these agreements made out. Part of what I do in my work is premarital counseling, and when people come in for that work, you know, I ask the question, what constitutes infidelity? And they say, well, you know, touching another person. And I say, well, what about online communication? And even couples who are younger and preparing for marriage at this point look at me like they've never had these conversations. So it is very, very critical. The other thing that happens is, even, you know, couples, whether they're younger or have been married quite a while or together quite a while, when they come into my office, working with infidelity treatment used to be rather straightforward. It was, you know, my partner cheated, and we would go through the betrayal and go through some of the process and, you know, how is the couple going to navigate from that? Now what's happening is you have one partner saying, well, my partner cheated, and the other person saying, no, I didn't, because their definitions are so different. So because of that ambiguity, our treatment for infidelity actually starts at a very different place than it used to 15 years ago.
And I wonder, too, if people consider it different talking to someone on the phone, you know, pre-internet. There might be people who think, gosh, you know, talking to an ex, you know, particularly regularly, would be seen as suspicious activity or somehow threatening to the current relationship. And I wonder if people perceive it differently because of social media, if it's online versus talking with someone, voice contact on the phone.
There are a couple things why it's perceived differently. I think it is. First of all, you know, as what's mentioned in this research, the element of secrecy becomes critical. I worked a little bit with Shirley Glass, who is an infidelity researcher prior to her passing away. And one of the things that she taught me was secrecy is a key definition. So if you're having phone communications, that's one thing. But if you are having communications via text or online, it is far easier to hide those interactions, which makes the perception very, very different. If you wouldn't show it to your partner, you probably shouldn't be doing it. A second piece related to online communication, which sort of affects the development of these relationships, is the level of self-disclosure. So, for example, you and I are on the phone right now, right? And you can sort of hear inflections in my voice, and, you know, you can hear a little bit more about what's going on with me. You'd be able to tell if there was a difference in my demeanor. If I started talking a little more slowly, or if I started doing some of these things, you might check in and say, hey, Kat, what's up? What's going on? Online, we don't have those cues. And so when we're communicating via text, or via messaging, we're doing a lot more self-disclosure. I have to tell somebody, here's my emotional state or here's what I'm going through. And because of that increased level of self-disclosure, these relationships that we have become much more dangerous much more quickly. We don't realize how much we're disclosing, and that disclosure means that we're connecting to other people, we're developing higher levels of commitment, higher levels of trust, and next thing you know, within a month or so, I feel like this person is my soulmate. And part of it is because of the medium and the disclosure that I've had to do.
Boy, that's such a great point. And if there isn't that degree of extra disclosure to communicate the subtleties, then that opens up the door for, you know, each individual in that online or social media communication to misinterpret what the other person is even meaning in the degree of intimacy or the reasons for reaching out. We'll continue our conversation with UNLV professor Catherine Hertlein. She's the primary author of the book, The Internet Family, Technology and Couple and Family Relationships. And Brad Wilcox directs the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia, where he's professor. We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back momentarily. Just 1 minute. Online emotional relationships are topic, and a new survey that looks at generational differences in attitudes about that kind of communication, sharing about relationships, about intimate emotional experiences with someone online. Is that a form of infidelity, or is that just a part of our world today and not necessarily threatening to relationships? 866-893-KPECC. David in Long Beach, good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me. I just want to share that, you know, in the past year or so, I did find out my husband, who had, you know, a relationship online with, you know, somebody else, but it's not really sexual. I mean, I did find that striking in the beginning, but as I come to understand, you know, certain things you may not be able to share with your life partner, and you do need somebody else to talk about it, and it's perfectly okay. As long as, you know, you are being upfront with your partner about it, there's really nothing to hide.
So your husband he discloses the nature of those online communications?
At first he didn't, but, you know, having that conversation, I think it made it easier for him to have the open kind of discussion with me. So I think sometimes it just takes the partner to come out and just be open about it and just start the conversation.
Was it an adjustment for you? I mean, was your first response being, well, God, you know, why doesn't he talk to me about this, or is he less committed to me because he's having this degree of emotional disclosure with someone online? Did you have to get past those emotions?
Oh, absolutely. I really felt like, well, you know, what is the life partner for if you can't share certain important things that you feel about it? But then, you know, I myself sometimes feel like certain things I want to talk to my close friend that I've known for a long time, but instead of talking to him, and that's something that every couple eventually will have to work on. But as we all kind of start having the conversation, I feel more open to, you know, him having his own friends to talk about. And it also makes me feel like I can talk to him about almost anything now. So I think it's a matter of having that open communications in the end.
David, appreciate it very much. David in Long Beach joining us. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Catherine Hertlein, professor UNLV, as well as a therapist in practice. How challenging is that with the clients that you work with, helping them get past that feeling like, what, I'm not good enough for my partner?
Yeah, it is really challenging, particularly because, you know, if there's a level of secrecy that's involved, that complicates things. And then there are some questions around comparison, right? So why is it that you felt like opening up to this person and not to me? I do agree with the caller, though. If you can have those conversations, it's great. Triangles in relationships are natural, where you go kind of seek out some advice or maybe, you know, unload on somebody else to get a perspective. Triangulation, where you're using that other person to avoid talking to your partner or avoid managing your anxiety in the relationship, that's a different story, and that's what can lead to a lot of complications.
Professor Brad Wilcox of University of Virginia and director of the National Marriage Project, what did this iFidelity survey show about the health of relationships related to these sorts of online emotional relationships?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to stress, as Scott Stanley has indicated, it's kind of helpful for us to have kind of fences up around our relationships and to steer clear of attractive alternatives in our lives. And this is true both in real life and our survey, it's true also online. So what we find is that people who are less likely to have a secret relationship, emotionally speaking, or less likely to sext, of course, and even less likely to be following an old boyfriend or girlfriend online, are more likely to report that they're very happy in their relationship, that they're very committed in their relationship, and they have a sort of a strong sense of their future together as a couple. And so the idea here is that when you maintain a fence against attractive alternatives, not only are you less likely to kind of get into trouble of one sort or another, but you're also more likely to kind of tend your own garden, to tend your own relationship, to focus on making it stronger and richer, and not let your attention and your, you know, your desires kind of migrate away from your spouse or your partner.
I would think, though, that when you come down to individual cases, it is possible that in the triangle relationships, as Professor Hertlein was just describing it, there can be relationships that are better for that, where, you know, it's a safety valve, so to speak, that there's an ability to share things that might be difficult within a relationship, like our caller was just talking about. So even though I understand that on average, relationships may be more vulnerable when these online emotional relationships form, I wonder if, you know, it there are cases where it's better for the couple.
Well, I think it's certainly the case that if you're going to have a kind of relationship with someone else who might be an attractive alternative to your spouse, or your partner, that it's important, as Kathy was saying, to be very honest with your spouse, your partner, about kind of the nature and character of that relationship. And I think it's also really important just to sort of gauge your own emotional temperature. And if you feel like there's some kind of attraction that's forming with this other person, it's incumbent upon you to break off that relationship. And just as I said, to be careful about forming such relationships in the first place because of the fact that they can be problematic for, you know, for the strength of your own marriage or your own relationship.
Professor Hertlein, I wonder if for some people that are in these online emotional relationships that they feel safe if the person is, you know, far away geographically, if there's no way they can really meet in person, and feel that that's kind of a safety zone that didn't exist in the past when you're talking about, you know, someone building an emotional relationship with someone they're seeing in person. And do you think that that's a false sense of security, or that that's legitimate, that distance can be a protector?
I think it's a false sense of security. You know, I agree with Dr. Wilcox in that, you know, there has to be some kind of boundary around you and your primary relationship, just to define it away from people. What happens online is that boundary becomes very permeable. I think if we decide that this person is far away, so therefore I can disclose more, or there isn't any risk here, then you're setting yourself up to go down a path of self-disclosure and building intimacy outside of your relationship. And by the time you figure out you've got a problem, you've already got a huge problem.
I want to thank you both for being with us. That's Professor Catherine Hertlein, UNLV, and Professor Brad Wilcox, who directs the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up next hour, we're going to be talking about how different cities in California deal with prostitution enforcement. You hear the term sex trafficking used a lot, which is kind of an umbrella term, but are we really talking about the same thing when we're talking about sex work? We'll be back momentarily. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Very good morning to you. I'm Larry Mantle. Over the course of the next hour, we're going to talk about sex work, prostitution specifically, and sex trafficking, where individuals are coerced or forced into sexual work. Sometimes those who are minors, other times adults who are also forced or coerced into the work. Over the course of the years of talking about this topic on Air Talk, I've noticed a pretty dramatic shift in the way this kind of activity is characterized. And much of it now is characterized just the umbrella term of sex trafficking. But what are we really talking about specifically? And are law enforcement approaches for what's called sex trafficking effective and appropriate in all the various ways that sex work takes place? KPCC investigative reporter Annie Gilbertson has taken on this issue and looked at the different ways cities are handling this. Annie, good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
So let's talk first of all about the research that you've done for this. Who are the different stakeholders you've talked to get their side of this enforcement issue?
Well, we took a hard look at some low-level arrests in Los Angeles, in this city. And what's interesting is that misdemeanor arrests are going down, but we saw one misdemeanor arrest that was across the board staying steady. And in fact, other research out of UCLA shows that misdemeanor arrests for prostitution are affecting Black women specifically. Their rate of arrest is going up. And that really triggered our interest in what's happening here. Why are we seeing so many Black women criminalized? So we looked at, talked to a variety of agencies, talked to the LAPD, the city attorney, the district attorney's office, the human trafficking task force here in Southern California, and other stakeholders to try to get a look at how often these women are being arrested in operations that are characterized as sex trafficking stings, but ultimately we've seen are affecting women who are accused of prostitution.
And is... Can one make fairly clear distinctions between those who are trafficked? In other words, they're coerced or forced into the work. They have an abusive pimp who's forcing them to do this, taking the proceeds, versus those who have made a decision, though the work is illegal, to do sex work.
Yeah, certainly, Larry. I mean, I think that law enforcement will be first to tell you that sometimes it can be difficult to tell the difference of a woman who is choosing to do sex work or maybe in a coercive situation or maybe had been exploited or abused in the past and may now be doing sex work on her own accord or his own accord. There's definitely a spectrum of experiences here where you have, very high end sex workers who are working $1,000, $2,000 an hour, who are women that are well-educated and are completely acting in their own volition. And then the other end, you have people that are being forced and coerced into what is called sex trafficking by sometimes a trafficker or a pimp, in some cases, will be holding things over these women, making them do this business. And so we really see a variety of experiences here.
Growing up in Los Angeles, particularly in Hollywood, street prostitution was just a fact of life. On my walk home from Hollywood High School, prostitutes were everywhere, male and female. That was just part of the landscape. With the internet, much of that went away. I know there have been industrial and working class neighborhoods, particularly in the San Fernando Valley and Inland Empire, where this has continued throughout. But much of the street prostitution seemingly went online to places like Backpage. So with Backpage's demise, are we seeing a resurgence in street prostitution?
You know, I haven't. I think when you talk to advocates and people who work on the ground, including other sex workers, they'll say that they've heard anecdotally of women who have left online type work to go out on the streets because, when enforcement kicked up online. But you've also heard from other women who just they simply moved to other online platforms, right, that were not Backpage. You saw that, too. I mean, I've heard of prostitution enforcement punishment compared to squeezing a balloon, right? That's the metaphor. Squeeze down on one space, and those sex workers just find other ways in which to conduct their business, whether that's in the streets or moving to other places online.
Annie Gilbertson, KPCC investigative reporter. You can read her piece at LAist.com. We have a link on the Air Talk page at KPCC.org. And we have a whole panel of guests who are going to be weighing in this hour on this topic. But I'd like to ask you, if you're someone who was in the sex trade or is in it currently, I'd like to hear about your experience and what do you think of the way that law enforcement or intervention programs deal with this. And that's whether you were someone who was recruited, coerced, forced into the work, or someone who made a choice of your own free will to do this because you'd prefer to do this than do other work. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Also with me is Susie Q. James, sex worker, member of the Board of Directors of the Adult Performer Advocacy Committee, and author of the book Truth, Justice, and the American Whore. Susie Q., good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry.
What's your sense of how things have changed during the time that you've been in the sex business?
So I started in the adult industry as a unionized worker in San Francisco, and I moved on to other types of work subsequently. And since the passage of SESTA-FOSTA, a piece of federal legislation that happened last year about the time I was came on and spoke to you last, around the time Backpage.
When Backpage went away.
Exactly. And those two things happened pretty much back to back in 2018. And what that essentially did was criminalize speech about sex on the internet. It took the ability for workers, regardless of how they entered the industry, be it choice, coercion, or horribly force. It took away folks' ability to put time, space, and scrutiny between them and someone who might want to harm them and get away with it. Because we know that sex workers have a rough time going to accessing law enforcement and accessing the things that they need to get out of potentially exploitative situations through law enforcement. We know that there's law enforcement in this state that will exploit a sex worker of their own accord. That's happened in the Bay Area. So that's really what we're looking at right now. Folks have less resources than ever, at least during my career. And losing the ability to advertise and screen clients on the internet and find community has been pretty devastating for folks.
Do you think there is a way for law enforcement to better differentiate between those who are in circumstances from which they need to be rescued versus those like yourself who are attempting to engage in this as your profession?
Yeah, I think the best way is to ask folks and to give them the empowerment to feel safe actually accessing justice in the way that other citizens can, right? So here in California, SB 233 was just signed into law by the governor, and we worked with stakeholders from San Francisco and Los Angeles and Sacramento to make sure that folks who are experiencing trafficking, rape, assault, can pick up the phone and can report when they are the victim or the witness of a violent crime. Prior to SB 233, that was not the case. Prior to SB 233, carrying more than three condoms could be put on a rap sheet when someone's being arrested. So these very basic levels of safety precautions, like carrying condoms and being able to call for law enforcement, those have been out of reach for our community for a very long time. And I think that moving forward, we're getting closer to a world where folks can actually access justice, but it's still very far off, especially for the most marginalized of our community, including Black and brown and trans sex workers.
We're talking with Susie Q. James, sex worker, member of the Board of Directors of the Adult Performer Advocacy Committee. And again, I'd like to hear from you if you have in the past or are currently doing sex work in the past, if you were someone who was coerced or forced into it was part of an abusive relationship of some kind, or you're someone who may Maybe you did it while you were in college or, you know, to get through school. And what was your experience with that? And what sort of interaction did you have with law enforcement along the way? That's the intersection that we're talking about in this hour. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me, the executive director of Journey Out, a Los Angeles-based nonprofit that works with victims of commercial sexual exploitation and sex trafficking. Stephanie Powell is a retired vice sergeant for the LAPD. She spent 30 years as a law enforcement officer in Los Angeles. Ms. Powell, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Having your law enforcement background, now working as an advocate and providing support services, how do you think the criminal justice system is serving those who are being abused?
So for me, I've been retired for about 5 years, and I have seen a huge paradigm shift, a more victim-centered approach as it pertains to human trafficking than what it was when I was actually on the job. I think that in order to identify, unfortunately, the victim of human trafficking, it does take law enforcement involvement. One thing that I can say statistically as it pertains to Journey Out, because we do get a lot of our clients through law enforcement, although we are doing outreach, we get them through hotlines, but we get a lot of them through the court system. One of the statistics that we were looking at was that from April 2017, we received 761 clients. Of those, 462 were self-described as human trafficking victims. So that's 60%. And so the other 40% either don't self-disclose or they're not victims of human trafficking. The question then becomes, how do we know that they're victims of human trafficking? One thing at Journey Out that we're proud of is that we, 50% of our employees are survivors. And so it's our survivors that are talking to these clients that are coming in.
So they may see themselves, they may have instincts because of their experiences that they can make that ID.
Absolutely. And the hard part of this is that human trafficking victims don't disclose. For several reasons, you know, they're afraid of their pimp, or they don't identify themselves as victims. So that becomes very hard. And when you're also talking about women of color, and you're talking about hotlines, they're not calling the hotlines because there's a historical distrust of government. So they're not going to call. When you look at Polaris's numbers of self-identification, just last year, it was 1,000 for African Americans. We know that there's more than that.
Well, and I would also assume even to call a hotline requires a certain sense of empowerment, right? To even do that. And if you've got someone whose just whole sense of self is destroyed, that's got to be a huge hurdle to overcome. I wonder if then even the 40% who don't describe themselves as being under the control of someone else, you suspect a significant numbers of those women have been under the control of someone else, but may feel shame about that, as you say, don't even think of it that way.
Absolutely. And because Journey Out deals with the adult victim of human sex trafficking, what we're finding is that for many of them, at some point as a minor, they were trafficked.
We're talking with Stephanie Powell, executive director of the nonprofit Journey Out. It's based in L.A. and provides resources, advocates on behalf of those who've been exploited in commercial sex trade. Retired vice sergeant with the LAPD, a 30-plus year career with the department and in law enforcement. Also with us, Susie Q. James, sex worker on the board of the Adult Performer Advocacy Committee, and KPCC investigative reporter Annie Gilbertson. And again, I'd like to hear from you. If you're someone who has personal experience with this, And it wouldn't even have to be that you yourself were involved in a sex trade or prostitution or other kinds. Maybe you're someone who's worked with people who are in that community and have had challenges. And you've seen up close, you know, Stephanie Powell's describing some of the challenges of breaking through and working with those in need. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Coming up, we'll talk with George Gascon, who is district attorney for San Francisco City and County. Now, San Francisco has taken a very different approach when it comes to sex work. We're going to talk about whether that's shifted historically in recent years. You can, of course, call in with your questions for any of our guests as well. 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. This hour of Air Talk, really spurred by the series that Annie Gilbertson, KPECC investigative reporter, has done, looking at the intersection of law enforcement, sex trafficking, and consensual sex work. And we're getting multiple perspectives on that. We welcome your calls at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Well, for many years, George Gascon has been coming on Air Talk going back to when he was a high-ranking LAPD official. For a number of years now, he's been district attorney for San Francisco City and County. We're going to talk with him about how San Francisco deals with what's been a big part of San Francisco's culture for many years, and that's sex work. George Gascon, good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry. Good to be here.
So you're a DA in the city. I mean, goes back to the Wild and Woolly Barbary Coast days, San Francisco, longstanding reputation of being a libertine city. How does San Francisco deal with the sex industry?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, until about 2011, we dealt, as far as law enforcement was concerned, it was a very similar approach to L.A., you know, people were arrested for prostitution, they were prosecuted, and, you know, women were generally targeted if they had condoms with them, which obviously creates major public health issues. So when I became DA in 2011, I began to look at this. I had members of the community coming to me and looking at the enforcement posture, both of the police department, but also the prosecution process in my office. And we came to the conclusion that we did not want to criminalize sex workers. And that began by, first of all, not using condoms as evidence of a crime way before SB 233 passed. We stopped using condoms as evidence of prostitution probably 7-8 years ago. And then, you know, frankly, we came to the conclusion that we were not going to prosecute sex workers for engaging in sex work, and that we wanted to be available to them if they were victims of sex trafficking or any other crime. We wanted to make sure that they felt that they were going to have access and without fear to law enforcement and the protection that we can offer. And we have, you know, we have seen a shift in our ability to work with many of the sex workers, usually women, but also young men that, you know, are being trafficked. The problem is that when you deal with this as a crime, meaning you criminalize the people that are engaged in the sex trade, they're not going to come to you, you know. And what we see often is we see conversations around sex trafficking operations, but when you look at the bottom line, what you're seeing is you're seeing a whole bunch of misdemeanor arrests for prostitution. And the sex workers are the ones that are being, they're the ones that are being arrested. They're the ones that are being prosecuted. Quite frankly, very few pimp, very few sex traffickers are actually subjected to any legal consequences. What? And then you have the problem with the impact that was mentioned before by Amy of, you know, the disproportionate impact on African American women.
Is there a difference in your ability in the San Francisco Police Department's ability to be able to identify those who are being sex trafficked, who are victims, by effectively decriminalizing sex work?
Well, you know, I think what it does is it creates a gateway for people to come to you for help when they're ready. It also creates a gateway for organizations like, for instance, Journey Out, that Stephanie is running, to be able to develop a different level of trust with the sex workers, because there can be a partnership with law enforcement, with your prosecutors, and people do not fear that they're going to be either incarcerated or prosecuted. You know, we hear cases even sometimes of sex workers that are victims of robbery or other violent crime, and because they refuse to provide testimony against their pimp, they get held in custody. I think our actions in law enforcement sometimes, we say one thing and what we do has a completely different approach. I don't believe that we have a better way of detecting volunteered sex workers from those that are being coerced or forced into it. I think that is a challenge. But what we do have is we create a gateway for people to come in when they're ready to report and give us access to them.
We're talking with George Gascon, who is the district attorney of San Francisco. To your point about safety, Natalie in Whittier says, I was a sex worker, and I think it should be legalized because it would make it safer. I had many dangerous incidents with clients. I think legalization would be a good start to making things safer. George Gascon, do you have a sense that since you've taken this non-prosecution approach to sex workers, that you have had them more likely to come forward and report incidents where they're victimized by clients or by people trying, prospective pimps, people like that?
Yeah, I believe that there is no question that the word on the street is that their sex workers are not going to be prosecuted for engaging in sex work. And I believe that that does have a positive impact. I think that the problem is that criminalizing prostitution has a whole bunch of negative consequences, including, health concerns, right? I mean, when you are using condoms, and I know that now we have SB 233 that no longer allows that, but, when you're prosecuting people because they're carrying condoms, what you do is you tell them, well, don't use a condom. Well, that obviously is a problem when you're having people that are trafficked. But if they come forward and they are unwilling to testify against their pimp, but they want services, but they're going to be prosecuted because they're unwilling to testify against their pimp, that is a problem. They're not going to come to you. So you have all these layers of really negative consequences from taking a criminal justice approach towards a sex worker that really needs to end.
George Gascon, District Attorney for San Francisco, with us. KPCC investigative reporter Annie Gilbertson, whose series addressed this again. It's at LAIS.com and our link on our AirTalk page, KPCC.org. Annie, how does the San Francisco approach compare and contrast with Los Angeles?
It's actually quite different here in Los Angeles. They prosecute here. So in L.A., we're talking about thousands of prosecutions every single year. Most of the women prosecuted are Black women. So some statistics are that, about 9% of L.A.'s female population are Black. About 65% of the arrests are Black women. So that's hugely disproportionate. And oftentimes these arrests, these operations are happening under the guise of human trafficking enforcement. So that's what our city leaders say, city council members, our city attorney, Mike Feuer, the LAPD often calls these operations human trafficking enforcement. And what they do is they go out, they'll do a variety of types of operations, pose as sex workers themselves, do stings online where they're inviting sex workers to do an out call. And then there's a sting at a hotel, or they just do sweeps of the prostitution tracks, the Sepulveda Boulevard in the San Fernando Valley or the Figueroa Street in South L.A. And what our analysis of these arrests has shown is that they're arresting very few trafficking suspects. Who they're arresting is women, and they're arresting Black women. And the city likes to say that these operations are being done to help women, to help these women escape the exploitations of sex work, to help these women escape pimps, to help these women escape their traffickers. And so the question I posed to the city attorney, well, why then would you prosecute these women? And he said, well, you know, prostitution, it's still a crime. So our city continues to prosecute.
Oh, we asked City Attorney Mike Feuer to join us on the program, and he was not made available to us to comment on this. But you hear the different approach. And of course, L.A. is not alone. We had the very recent prosecutions in Florida, the Robert Kraft case involving the owner of the New England Patriots NFL team, where a judge signed off on actually putting cameras in massage parlors because of law enforcement's allegation that human trafficking was going on, recording customers by the admission of police who were just getting massages along with people who were allegedly getting sexual services. And there was no evidence presented. There was actual trafficking of the workers who were in those massage parlors. So this is something that's been in the news across the United States as the term sex trafficking has sort of, you know, taken over all of these law enforcement efforts.
And if I may add to that, Larry, you know, one of the other consequences, other than the consequences on these women's lives, where if they do choose to leave sex work, this arrest is going to make it that much harder to do so. But the other consequences is that when you're talking about trafficking and you're throwing all these resources at what is essentially prostitution enforcement, you're not actually helping the many trafficking victims that are in Los Angeles, in which Los Angeles is a hotbed for trafficking. I mean, sex trafficking, of course, but also, like, you know, garment workers, people who are being exploited as farm workers. There's a variety of ways in which people can be exploited for their labor. And advocates say that that's really just being lost in this conversation as they conflate prostitution and trafficking.
Again, I welcome your calls, your questions for any of our guests about their experiences on this intersection of law enforcement with sex work and with coerced or forced sex trafficking. 866-893-KPECC. Tika in Long Beach, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, I noticed as a survivor and also as a service provider that a lot of the women that come from these marginalized communities don't have a great relationship with law enforcement and or the court systems or even a lot of the service providers. So what I've noticed is that when we do these sting operations, and yes, there are some consequences that go behind that, but the best thing that I've seen is that they start to have these relationships with law enforcement. So if something was to happen to them, or if and when they're tired and they're ready to get out, they know that they can go to this particular police station, ask for the vice officers or even the sergeant or lieutenant of these enforcement or law enforcement areas, and they can ask them for help, and they will hook them up or trying to link them up with other organizations that can be able to help them get the resources that they need.
Tika, for you, what changed your circumstances? You were trafficked?
Yes, I was trafficked before human trafficking was even a phrase. And I had to figure it out myself. There wasn't any sting operations. There weren't any organizations that were available. The internet wasn't even really a thing at that time. So I just had to figure it out. Being under a pimp control from the age of 12 to the age of 18, and then essentially having to engage in victimizing myself from the age of 18 to 23. I don't consider myself a sex worker because if I had another choice, I would have done something else other than engaging in prostitution.
Tika, really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Stephanie Powell, Executive Director of the nonprofit Journey Out. You want to respond to what she's brought up?
Yes, I have so many things to respond to, but I know we only have so much time. One of the things that I think is extremely important as we're having the subject of sex working and human trafficking is that there is a distinction between the two. Human trafficking victims are not out there because they want to be out there. They're out there as a result of force, fraud, or coercion. It's two different things. It's apples and oranges. And I do agree that victims of human trafficking should not be criminalized because it does make it very hard for them to find a job. The bigger question becomes, then how do I find that victim? How do I find that client of mine who has been forced into prostitution since the age of 12. And now they are still out there as a result of survival. It's just like what Tika said, is that a lot of them are out there because it becomes survival, because they've had so many arrests, because I have clients out there that have their pimps' names tattooed on their faces. Where are they going to get a job? And when you talk about African-Americans, and I'm an African-American woman, I think it's important is that why are they out there? Why are they out there in the first place? Are they out there because a pimp has talked them into being out there? Are they out there because of poverty? See, there's systematic failures. So what you are seeing when you see that African-American girl or woman out there is the end result of systematic failures. And that system is not just the justice system. That system is the foster system, social system, education, health. There's a lot to this. So it's not just African-American women that are being arrested. That's who's out there. That's who's out there on Figueroa and Western, because they're still out there. Because if you go out there in the middle of the night, you are going to see 30 to 40 girls in a 5-mile radius. Mixed in there, you may have some that are out there because they choose to be out there, but you're also seeing a lot that are out there as a direct result of human trafficking. How do we get them? I mean, and I really believe that law enforcement, it's an ugly thing. I do believe that because I've had clients that said, if I had not been arrested, I would not have known where to go to get help. So how do we find them? Because there is outreach. There's other ways. How do we find them?
And Tika talking about even a way of, you know, sort of formalizing this, that women could go to the officer who's involved and say, I need help, and have a way out. We'll continue our conversation. That's Stephanie Powell, executive director of the nonprofit Journey Out, which works with those who've been sexually exploited and sex trafficked. Retired Vice Sergeant, LAPD, 30 years as a law enforcement officer. Susie Q. James, sex worker on the Board of Adult Performer Advocacy Committee. George Gascon, DA for San Francisco. And Annie Gilbertson, KPCC investigative reporter, whose work has really set the framework for our conversation on Air Talk. We'll be back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up next here on 89.3. Hannah Shaw will be Terry's guest, a.k.a. the Kitten Lady. She rescues orphaned neonatal and older kittens, teaching people how to care for them. And she has a new book, Tiny But Mighty. That's Terry Gross with the Kitten Lady, Hannah Shaw, on Fresh Air coming up next. Right now, our focus is on sex trafficking, sex workers, the intersection with law enforcement, and we have four guests with expertise to talk with us about the issue, as well as listeners providing expertise at 866-893-KPECC. Kim in Highland Park, I understand you're a sex worker. How many years have you been a provider in the field?
Hi, Larry. I have been working in different aspects of sex work for 6 years.
Okay. And what types of work have you done?
So I have been everything from a dancer, that's how I started, to doing online sugar babying, which, you know, is a euphemism for legal reasons. And I've also done cam work, but that has been stifled greatly and was the safest means of sex work. But I can no longer do it because of SESTA FOSTA. It's very difficult to promote.
And so your thoughts about how sex work is enforced and law enforcement's ability to differentiate between those coerced and forced versus those, it sounds like you're presenting that you do this as a choice for work.
Exactly. And I understand that there's many people who have no choice. And I have been in some positions where when I was younger, I didn't have as much job experience outside. And so I understand that for just financial reasons, many people have less options. But basically, it's great that you're talking about this issue, because humanizing us really helps and people caring about us, both voters and legislators, because so often we're dehumanized and just demonized. It's awful.
I want to ask you, Kim, about a question from a listener, Wendy in Huntington Beach, who called and said, why aren't people on the demand side being arrested instead of victims being prosecuted? I'm critical, Wendy says, of identifying these people as clients. Kim, I don't know how you call, you know, what you call your customers or client, however you, but what do you think of Wendy's point that those who seek services like yours should be arrested?
Well, I believe that type of thinking is called the Nordic model. I'm sure one of your experts can correct me if I'm wrong. But that also hurts us because it makes people unlikely to send us their picture or use their real phone number or any kind of information that we can verify who they are. And that actually puts us in jeopardy. Even if we don't go to jail, we are still at risk of being attacked by clients who we don't have any information on because they're so afraid. And I understand, you know, that she may think that these people are not good, but, you know, except for agender people, sex is a very normal part of life for many people, you know, so there's no reason to hate on them.
Kim, I appreciate your call. Thanks so much for sharing your experiences. Let me go back to San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon. George, does your office prosecute, however you want to call them, customers, clients, Johns, whatever term you want to use for them?
Generally, we don't. We put them through a diversion program that goes into the, you know, sort of the facts around sex work and the impact that often sex trafficking has on sex work, especially on the streets. And we see that diversion program works really well. We very seldom have any repeat offenders that come out of that process. But I have to agree with your last caller. I think that we have to continue to evaluate a way to separate trafficking from people that are willing to engage in sex work and figure out a way to understand that that's a reality and how do we deal with the criminalization of this process. Look, I get the concept that you want to reach people that are in need and that, you know, sometimes we're making arrests to do this, but I wish if we took the approach that the medical profession has taken to the work and start by taking an oath to doing no harm. The problem that we have when we go out and arrest 150 women in order to get one pimp or one trafficker is that we are leaving a trail of victims along the way that are not being helped at all by this process. We're harming more people than we're helping. And until we come to the realization that whatever we do, whatever interventions law enforcement can do, the result should never be that you're creating more harm than the good that you're doing.
Let's take another call. This is from Indushri in the Mid-Wilshire District. You're on Air Talk. I understand that you're a psychologist and you work with those who've been trafficked?
Yes, correct. I actually have a nonprofit called Project Satori, and we provide comprehensive mental health care services for survivors of human trafficking in Los Angeles and in other parts of the world. And I wanted to speak to the importance of decriminalizing sex workers because from a mental health perspective, several things go wrong when these girls are arrested. Most of them have severe mental health issues, including complex PTSD and, you know, different types of psychiatric issues. And there's often a shattered sense of self and ego as well. So the idea that they're going to seek help, it becomes even more complicated and less likely when they're arrested. And in my experience, our organization funds treatment specifically to help with this issue. Because for example, victims of crime, there are wonderful programs that seek to provide services, mental health care services for survivors. But for example, you know, that program requires that girls file a police report. And some girls will refuse to do that because they're terrified. And they are often you know, so paranoid about whether, you know, who is safe and how can people be safe and, you know, who are they talking to? Because there's people who are corrupt in the system as well.
Indushree, I really appreciate your call. Thank you for being with us. Let me go back to Susie Q. James, sex worker on the board of Adult Performer Advocacy Committee. Do you think decriminalization, you know, formal decriminalization is the best approach? And if so, then how do you get to the issue of coercive or forced sex work?
Absolutely. So, yes, decriminalization of sex work is incredibly important to dismantling those generations of barriers when it comes to distrust between law enforcement and all kinds of marginalized folks, not just Black and brown folks, but LGBTQ youth have a really hard time going to law enforcement. And, you know, I think that folks on the panel with a background in law enforcement know how hard it is to land a human trafficking conviction. That is hard. Arresting a young Black woman is easy. And I think that's the problem here. And once, regardless of how that person got into sex work, once you have an arrest on your record, once you go through that process of being booked and arrested, the likelihood that you will leave the industry plummets. It's just we are getting in our own way. There's a hole in the bucket of how we address the problem of human trafficking, and that hole is criminalization. Until we decriminalize fully and fill that hole, we will be continuing to pour resources into a bucket with a hole in it.
Susie Q, are you comfortable talking about your interaction with law enforcement, or is that a place you'd rather not go in this conversation?
Oh, no, I'm happy to talk about.
So have you had your problems with police?
I am not. I am a cisgendered, white-presenting, college-educated woman. And my interactions with law enforcement look a lot like this. I get the opportunity to sit down with a DA. I get the opportunity to sit down with law enforcement, and other folks don't get that because of the generations of systemic violence, racism, and inequity. And that's what we have to dismantle. That's a lot harder than just arresting a girl on Figueroa.
Susie Q. James, sex worker, also author of Truth, Justice, and the American Whore. Ann in West Adams says, when I was a sex worker in the 80s, my abusive pimp was the economy. My abusive pimp was the rent I had to pay on our overpriced apartment, the tuition for my children's education, so they didn't have to go to a bad school in a bad neighborhood and end up living the circumstances I did with no other option than sex work. There are a lot like myself in the middle ground between trafficked women and voluntary sex workers, women who are choosing to do it only because they don't have other choices. That's Ann in the West Adams District. We'll continue our conversation on Air Talk in just 1 minute. Tomorrow on Film Week at 11 here on 89.3, our critics let us know about Richard Linklater's new film, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Cate Blanchett stars. The Angry Birds Movie 2, the new animated film of the week, and Good Boys, an R-rated film which features three sixth-grade boys as the protagonists. That's quite a juxtaposition. We'll hear what our critics think of that comedy as well as all the other films out tomorrow. That's Film Week, 11 o'clock every Friday right here on 89.3 KPCC. Right now, we're talking about the intersection of law enforcement with sex work and with sex trafficking. KPCC investigative reporter Annie Gilbertson has been reporting on this. Her piece is up at las.com, linked to kpcc.org AirTalk page. So, Annie, what are the diversion models here in Los Angeles available?
Right. So the city says, look, we go out, we do these operations, we find minors who have been coerced into the sex trade. You can't arrest a minor in California for prostitution anymore. That law changed. So they're finding women to rescue, but they're also arresting a number of sex workers who are adults. And what happens is they end up going to court and they're offered a diversion program, or many of them are offered a diversion program. And the city says, like, this is their way out of sex work. This is going to help them get on their feet. They'll have access to housing services, employment services, help them choose another line of work or get away from an abusive pimp or trafficker. But when we look down at the figures in our reporting, we found that this isn't happening for most women. In fact, what we see is that 90% of cases that are filed in court do not end in diversion. For Black women, it's even fewer cases end in diversion. 95% go all the way through sentencing and conviction, which means that they're left left with a misdemeanor arrest record for prostitution. So I really call into question this idea that these arrests are leading women to a better life, because when you look down at the data, that's just not happening.
Do we know why they're not getting into diversion programs and it's going all the way through the criminal justice system?
There's several reasons why. I think that the city attorney's office, they know their numbers are very low, and they would like to see more women go into diversion. So they're trying to offer a new pilot process where it's a pre-arrest or a pre-filing diversion. So once the sex worker is apprehended, before the case is filed in court, then they're offered diversion, and they're hoping that this works better for some women. But there's a variety of reasons why sex workers aren't choosing diversion. One very obvious reason is that they don't see the consequences as that great once they're convicted, right? LA County jails are full. They're not likely to spend a bunch of time in behind bars. Maybe they already have a criminal conviction. They're like, I'll just take my plea deal and, you know, get out of my way. I'm going to go back to sex work. Some don't take it because they have no intention of leaving sex work. Others don't take it because they may be under in an exploitative situation with a trafficker or a pimp who may be telling them not to take the diversion deal. That they obviously have an incentive to keep these women in their stable. They don't want them to get help.
All right. Let me go back to Stephanie Powell, executive director of the nonprofit Journey Out, which works with those who've been exploited in sex work. Stephanie, how would you change the system? If you could wave a magic wand and make it better, what would you do?
I'd start by adjusting the system, period, our broken system in terms of social services, foster system. It's not just the justice system. It's all the systems that are broken. I would start with fixing that. One thing that I do want to address is that our statistics at Journey Out are a little different, and that's where I started off the program. Out of those that we are getting from the court system, 60% have identified as human trafficking victims. And I also want to say to the caller that just called, because I think this is really important, especially coming from law enforcement, is that I don't believe that a victim should have to file a police report in order to be deemed a victim. We have an intake process in which we're able to identify them without them having to identify their trafficker in order for them to seek help.
And that exists now.
Yes, that's what we do.
So you don't have to file a plea. You can come in and say, hey, I want out, and you'll be helped?
You could be a sex worker that decides, I don't want to do this anymore, and we will help you as well. We help anybody that wants to come to our doors. It's not a moral judgment. We really, we go down their path. We assist them in their path of what it is that they want to do. Does the diversion program have some pros and cons? Absolutely, it does. I think some of the pros is that for those that do seek help, there's resources out there that we and organizations like us at Journey Out would be able to provide. I think the downside is when someone has to plead no contest in order to get diversion, or the slow process of vacatures and expungements. Having said that, that's why that pre-filing piece is so extremely important. We do realize that people do not take diversion programs for various reasons. But at Journey Out, what we do is we're embedded in some of the police departments within LAPD with a survivor that actually goes in and talks to people that have been arrested for prostitution to talk about our diversion program and to talk about the pre-filing program, because that's so important.
I just need to wrap, but quickly, you find a lot of women willing to volunteer to help who've gone through this, wanting to help others who are in this circumstance?
Yes, especially when you have a survivor that's talking to them, because that helps the trust of the system.
Thank you so much. That's Stephanie Powell, Executive Director of Journey Out. My thanks to Susie Q. James of the Adult Performer Advocacy Committee. And my thanks as well to George Gascon, District Attorney of San Francisco, and KPCC investigative reporter Annie Gilbertson, whose work on this helped to frame our conversation on this intersection between law enforcement, sex work that's consensual, and forced or coerced sex trade. Thank you so much, Annie, for with us. GennerPeaceLAS.com, or you can link to it, the AirTalk page, KPCC.org. Fresh Air is next. Have a great afternoon.